Welcome back to Podcast Royal. We have had an eclipse this week. King Charles and Queen Camilla's wedding anniversary is today as we record April 9th. Meghan visited a children's hospital last week. She read to kids, and Scoop came out on Netflix, but more on that later. So first and foremost, of most importance, how are you, my friend?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. We were just talking offline about just how like life is too busy and how I don't think that this is a whole other podcast, but I don't think life was meant to be as busy, and you and me and just like everything. It's just so busy. I think you and I both need a vacation, and I wish we could go on it together. It's just crazy town over here.
I know. And we were also just talking about the eclipse. I know you mentioned it at the top of the episode. And I know a lot of people traveled to see the eclipse, and I'm kind of wishing I had been one of those people, because all of the footage I have seen has just been incredible. So
did you watch it yesterday, or did you go out and look at it yesterday?
So I did not think to purchase any special glasses, but mm-hmm. I will say I am not in the path of totality, but I was watching outside to see if I noticed any changes in the sky, and it did get noticeably dimmer mm-hmm. here. The sun kind of seemed to, mm-hmm. I don't know, just get a little bit darker, you know, for a little while, and then I saw it come back out. So yep. I think that was the eclipse we had here. I didn't get to look directly at it though.
I didn't look at it either, but we did go outside, and it looked like it went all of a sudden from being like early afternoon to dusk, like in a moment. And so that was super cool. And I have to confess that like I'm not really a sciencey person, but I like am a low key like space nerd lover. Like I just am mm-hmm. super like, this is a really random interest that I have. And I know that the eclipse isn't, I guess it's kind of space, but anyway, it was interesting. And I wish that like we actually thought to go get glasses at Lowe's, because Lowe's apparently sold eclipse glasses, but our Lowe's was sold out. So anyway, but we didn't look at directly at it, but we did, you could, as you said, you could definitely tell that there was a noticeable shift. But anyway, well, I want to start this episode off by reading this lovely email from our listener, Tina. She wrote in and said, "Hi, ladies. I love your podcast. You girls are so real and fun. You manage to keep it serious when it needs to be and lighthearted when content allows. I know you've mentioned Princess Diana's backup wedding dress and wondered about its whereabouts. This week's People magazine with Valerie Bertinelli on the cover has a story about the wedding dress designer and the story behind the backup dress. And we are going to cover that in the Royal Rundown, Tina." So she continues, "You ladies are killing it. I know you all are very busy and doing great work. Congratulations and thanks for the hard work you put into Podcast Royal. It's very informative, if I could speak." So thank you so much, Tina. You really
thank
don't know.
You.
Yeah, you don't know how much emails like these mean. And as I said, we will definitely get into Diana's second wedding dress in the Royal Rundown. But before we do, as I said, today is April 9th. I want to mention very briefly that as we record today, this marks the third, unbelievably, the third anniversary of the death of Prince Philip. So wow. I just wanted to acknowledge that. And I don't know where the time has gone. And then I also imagine today is a rather poignant 19th wedding anniversary for the King and Queen, given all that has happened this year. So shall we get into the meat of the episode?
Yes, let's jump right into the Royal Rundown. And I have to ask you, Rachel, right off the bat, I want to know what you thought about Scoop, because yes. I know you mentioned it. You were saying you were looking forward to seeing it a while back, and it's available now on Netflix. So I have to hear your thoughts, because I know I said I wasn't too sure what I thought about it.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you in a second if you plan on seeing it, but I actually watched it a few weeks ago, and I really enjoyed it. It's very short. It's only, I think, 93 minutes long. And to be honest with you, it's less about Andrew and more about the women who set up the interview for BBC's Newsnight. So those women are Sam McAllister, Emily Maitlis, Esme Warren. I actually had the opportunity to interview Sam for Marie Claire, and the movie is actually, she's really the main character. Like, you maybe think that Andrew is going to be the main character of the movie, but it's really Sam McAllister, who is a really interesting person. She's played by Billy Piper in the movie. The movie's based off of her book. I've read the book. I recommend it. That book is called Scoops, Behind the Scenes of the BBC's Most Shocking Interviews. It does talk about the Andrew interview, but it talks about a lot of other interviews too. So I'm going to venture a guess that you haven't seen it. So the better question probably is, do you plan to see it?
Yeah, I have not seen it yet because I saw in the news that it was available and I just had not had a chance to watch it. But I will say the reviews I've heard are similar to what you've said with, Andrew maybe not being the central focus, and I've heard it's pretty good. So I'll have to add it to my watch list. I've got a few on my watch list right now because occasionally I will swap out my streaming services. So I'll try one for a little while and then I'll go to a different one. And I've just reactivated my Hulu account and forgot how much is available
There's
on
a ton on
Hulu.
Hulu. Yeah.
But yes, I'm adding that one to my watch list.
Well, let me give you a couple of enticing. Well, I don't know if this will entice you. It might actually creep you out and make you not want to watch it. But there is a really interesting scene. Interesting is a loose term of the teddy bear stuff. Andrew's teddy bear weirdness. And fun fact, listeners, if you've seen the movie, you might want to go back and rewatch this scene. The I guess the housekeeper that is doing a poor job in Andrew's estimation of rearranging his teddy bears, that's actually Kate Winslet's daughter, Mia Threapleton. So I thought that was a cool nugget.
Interesting.
There's a scene of Rufus Sewell, who plays Andrew, getting out of the bath, and you see his naked bottom. And this is like the most embarrassing thing I've if someone ever plays me in a movie and has to do what Rufus Sewell did and wear a large butt prosthetic to play me, then I'm gonna just like die. I mean, as if Andrew is not mortified enough, that piece of information probably is
I
not great.
am cracking up laughing at all of the crazy words that you say on this podcast.
What crazy word? Butt prosthetic? Yeah, I know. Like
Yeah, there's
the
always something in the news that prompts
things that
some kind of word that we never thought we would say.
Yeah. And then so as I said, it just came out last Friday. I don't want to spoil it, although it's difficult honestly to spoil an interview that already happened 5 years ago. But I will say that, and this might entice you to, and it's a great movie. Like, seriously, everyone should watch it. It's really good, and it is quick. Like, there's no extra like excess that doesn't need to be there. But there was a royal family member who you definitely you, Jessica, but everybody will know, who appeared in a place in the film where I did not expect this person to. When you watch, you'll know exactly what I mean. And I really liked the movie. And I'm wondering what you listeners thought. So DM
Okay.
us, tell us if you saw Mia Threapleton and knew that was Kate. I mean, she did look vaguely familiar, but now that I know that, that makes a whole lot of sense. And I really, really enjoyed the movie and love royal movies because they don't really come out that often, right? I think the last one was probably Spencer with Kristen Stewart, and that was in 2021. So
Now
gotta
you've
say,
intrigued me, and
you should
I'll
watch.
have to go watch.
It's only an
Okay.
hour and a half. Just, you can watch it really quickly, and it's when you do, we'll chat about it. But
And I've still got my Netflix subscription, so
there you go. There,
there we
I
go.
would loan you mine to use it if you didn't. But I think it's definitely worth a watch, even if you don't follow the Royals. But obviously, everyone who's listening does, because otherwise, why would you be here? But all right, so let's go back to what Tina was saying and talk about Princess Diana's wedding dress. Was not expecting this to be in the headlines this week, but Elizabeth Emanuel gave an interview to People magazine and just kind of revealed a lot of interesting information. So, per Tina's email, there has been a lot coming out about Princess Diana's wedding dress, even though that was 43 years ago. I should actually say dresses, plural. So, as Tina alluded to, Elizabeth Emanuel, she designed Princess Diana's wedding dress with her then husband, David Emanuel. Elizabeth confirmed to People that there was a backup wedding dress for Diana, but that was not news. We knew that. Diana actually never knew that the backup dress existed. And Elizabeth, who, as I said, with her ex-husband designed Diana's gown, Elizabeth doesn't know where the original backup dress is. She did, however, make a recreation of it. And I'm going to drop a photo of it for you, Jessica. We can talk about this in just a second. So the spare dress differed substantially from Diana's actual wedding gown, which we've all seen. This is an iconic piece of fashion history. Most notably, the backup dress lacked a long train. The original dress had I think, a 25-foot train. On the backup dress, the silk was white and not ivory. The backup dress had sleeves that were more fitted to Diana's arms with frilly cuffs. The original backup dress was actually never completed, and she, Elizabeth, searched through old sketches and thumbnail images from an old documentary, and she recreated the backup royal wedding dress to exhibit at the virtual Princess Diana Museum, which is my new obsession in life, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, thoughts on this backup wedding dress?
Okay, so the first thing that popped into my mind when I saw the dress was it kind of looked like something a colonial woman in 1700s America would have worn.
Emmanuel's cannot catch a break on the show. Yes, I don't disagree with you.
I was like, it's giving Martha Washington.
You go with your Gen Z lingo. It's giving. Oh my gosh. I can't.
No, you know, I was thinking about, I don't know if you liked American Girl dolls when you were younger, Felicity, how, you know, I think she was from like colonial America, 1700s. It kind of reminded me of like a dress she might wear with the.
I was a Samantha girl myself personally, but that's
me
just
too. Me too. I had a Samantha doll, but anyway, back to colonial wear, just the cut overall. But I thought it was interesting that it was giving kind of those American colonial vibes, given that it was, you know, for a British princess, although who knows, maybe that was British fashion in the 1700s also. But when I look at the two dresses, like if we're comparing both of them, this replica of the backup dress and then her actual wedding gown, I think the overall cut of this dress is more flattering, actually, in my opinion. So the sleeves are much more fitted. There's a lot less material around the bodice. And, you know, we've got the slimmer shoulders. And I think that makes it a more desirable dress, in my opinion. It also appears on the mannequin to be a bit more low cut than her actual wedding dress. Didn't you think so?
I think so. Yeah, I do. And, you know, it's difficult not having it on the body because what we're looking at is just on a mannequin. But yeah, it does appear that way.
And I know we've talked a lot about Diana's actual wedding gown. And so I do want to call this out. You know, it was very representative of 80s bridal gown trends. And to me, her actual wedding gown, when I think about it, feels a little bit like runway fashion. So, you know, like when you see fashion on the runway during like Paris Fashion Week, those outfits sort of inspire all the trends that we see in the upcoming seasons, but they're always a lot more exaggerated on the runway compared to like normal everyday street fashion.
Yeah.
And to me, her dress sort of feels like that. It's like an exaggerated version of a lot of the trends that we saw in, you know, 80s bridal.
That's a good way to put it, actually.
But I think, you know, the backup dress to me, it feels a little bit more toned down. It feels like something you might actually see on a bride. It does still have a very full ball gown, but I don't feel like it's overwhelming. I don't feel like it would swallow a bride. And I think if I were shopping for a gown and those were my two options, I would go with the backup dress. So I want to know your thoughts on this.
100% agree with you. I mean, if from no one else, my mother gives me so much grief for just not connecting, let's just put it that way, with Princess Diana's wedding dress. I also was not alive in 1981. I was born in 1986. So, you know, I know it was a dress of the time, but I prefer this dress as well. Again, it's difficult to compare and contrast because this dress is on a mannequin and it's not on a body. But from what I can see of it, I prefer this gown. Now I do love the part of Diana's dress that I go gaga for is the train. And this dress doesn't have that. I mean, you can't see in this picture that we're looking at if it even has a train at all, but I know because I did the research that it doesn't have a 25-foot train. So, I mean, if I were the bride and I had to choose between the dress that we all know and this dress, I would pick this dress for sure.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
So a side note, while Sarah Burton for Alexander McQueen, who designed Kate's dress in 2011, and Claire Waite Keller for Givenchy, who designed Meghan's dress in 2018, if you'll remember, those designers were not known until pretty much the wedding day, like pretty much right up until the point of their respective weddings. Like I remember there was actually people thought that the Emmanuels might have been designing Meghan's dress, but I remember when Meghan got out of the car at St. George's Chapel, that's when it was announced that it was Givenchy. And then everybody was speculating in 2011, if you remember, about who was designing Kate's, and it was just a big, big secret. And but the Emmanuels were actually known to be the designers of Diana's dress well in advance of the wedding. So everybody knew, like people would like stand outside the Emmanuel's shop and the journalists would go through their trash trying to find hints of what the dress would look like. And if you will remember, listeners, the Emmanuels designed Diana's engagement blouse back in February of 1981. And then it was no secret that once Diana commissioned them to design the dress, that they were the designers chosen. So I don't know what changed, like why it became a secret from one generation to the next. I don't have that answer. But so more dress news. In addition to recreating Diana's backup dress, which Elizabeth said she created because, I think this is funny, because she was neurotic and afraid that something might, and I don't blame her. I would have done the same thing. It's like the wedding of the century, right? Like you have to be prepared. But she said she did it because she was afraid something might go wrong with the original, didn't want to be left empty-handed. Elizabeth is also creating, I'm super interested in this. She's creating a modern interpretation of the 1981 dress that we all know and recognize. So she is calling this the sequel to Diana's dress. Diana's dress, I mean, again, you can picture it, listeners, but it had a ruffled collar, puffed sleeves, that 25-foot train. So this is all to People magazine. Elizabeth said, "I'm going to try and capture the spirit of the original, but through my eyes now. I want to preserve all the sparkles and pearls, but with a completely different vision." So she added, "It's a really exciting thing because I often get asked, would you do the same dress again?" And she said, "Well, I wouldn't change a thing on the dress in 1981. But if I was looking at it through my eyes now, there are so many possibilities." So I'm really interested to see how that turns out.
Yeah, that's something I really can't wait to see either. And I will say, you know, going back to Princess Diana's real dress, I feel like we criticize it a little bit because it's not really our style. But we have to give it some credit because it did ultimately inspire the whole wedding industry totally at the time. And brides really followed her influence with the big sleeves and the full gowns. So whether or not it was too much or whatever you think about that, we can't deny just the massive impact that it had on fashion, which is mm-hmm. a really big deal. So I would really love to see what comes out of this new project, seeing, you know, her dress through a modern day lens and how this designer views fashion from like a 2024 Princess Diana perspective. So that will be really cool to see.
Yeah, I'm really interested. And I almost feel like I need to apologize before this next news item because this is going to time suck your entire day if you go on to the Princess Diana Virtual Museum. So I want to briefly mention this. It's called the Princess Diana Virtual Museum. I just learned about this through this story, actually. So it is just what it sounds like. It's as if Diana had her own museum, but you can tour it all online. So the collection features everything from her teenage years to the wedding, to magazine covers, portraits, life as a mom, life as a royal, her dresses, so much more. So there's a lot there. You can get a one-day pass for $9.95. You can get a one-week pass for $19.95 and a one-month pass for $29.95. And there is enough there to keep you busy for a month. Honestly, true Diana lovers will need more than a day. I'll just tell you that. You can easily fall down the rabbit hole here. So I got to tell you, this is so cool. I don't know how I didn't know this existed. And I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know when it came to be, but I'm so glad that I know it. Like if I'm having a bad day, I'm paying $10 and I'm going on the Princess Diana virtual museum. Like you can just see me later. Cause I'm going to the museum. And I want to read this from the homepage. After Princess Diana's death, her personal belongings were sold at private auctions and scattered all over the world. It is our mission and passion to preserve as many of her personal belongings, now historical items, as we can in one place, the Princess Diana Museum. With over 1,800 pieces, so cool, of Diana's most iconic, carefully curated personal and historical artifacts, we currently house one of the largest collections in the world. Displayed in a 3D interactive environment, the virtual museum spans Diana's lifetime from early childhood through her teenage years and until her tragic death, depicting her incredible life and legacy. I actually found out about the Princess Diana Virtual Museum because Elizabeth Emanuel's the picture that we were just looking at is in the museum. So, oh. And I wonder if I can't remember if this, I don't know if this was in the story, but if she's probably going to put the recreation of the original dress in the museum as well. And I do remember that the museum curator said that, you know, you can't put a price on history. So I don't know what she paid them, but it sounds like a lot. So you can visit the museum for yourself by going to forgive me here. There is a backstory behind this. There's a reason why it's called this, the Princess and the Platypus. .org. Platypus is spelled Platypus. So the Princess and the Platypus.org. It's an interesting name, I know, but there's actually a really poignant and beautiful backstory to why it's called that. I'm not going to spoil it. You can find out for yourself, but I encourage you listeners to visit the site to find out the reason yourself and just really immerse yourself in all things Diana. I personally am obsessed, and I got the day pass, but I think I'm going to have to go get the week pass, and I'll probably end up getting the month pass because it's just really a good escapism.
A lot of cool Princess Diana content in this.
Not expecting that. You know what? Not expecting it, but here for it.
Well, let's go ahead and transition to some news items that happened this week with our royals. So first, I want to talk about the changing of the guard ceremony at Buckingham Palace on Monday. This was pretty cool. So we had French troops at Buckingham Palace, and I saw a lot of chatter online about what was going on, why it might be. And, you know, I'm sure that was intentional. They were probably trying to bring awareness to that. But British and French troops actually swapped places on Monday to complete the changing of the guard ceremony at each other's palaces. So this was actually the first time this has ever been done. No other country outside of the Commonwealth has ever participated in this ceremony at Buckingham Palace. And the reason was to mark 120 years since the signing of the Entente Cordiale. And I have no idea if I'm saying that correctly. I did my very best. But
I don't know. We're human listeners.
But if you are wondering what that means, so it was a series of agreements that were signed both by France and the UK back in 1904, and it was to acknowledge a stronger relationship between the two. So it wasn't a formal alliance, but it was a really important show of friendship. And I just, you know, being someone who follows royals and being someone who loves this, you know, British culture, I really like the tradition of the changing of the guard. I think it's really cool. And for listeners out there who maybe you're newer to this or you've never seen this before, this is the ceremony that takes place at Buckingham Palace when the on-duty soldiers, known as the Old Guard, they change their shifts with the new guard coming on duty. And they kind of, you know, they take over. And so they go through this ceremony. And on Monday in Paris, we had President Macron. He watched the ceremony there. And then in London, we had the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh watching at Buckingham Palace. So they were actually standing in for King Charles, who we know is not able to go to quite as many official royal engagements right now. But I do want to talk, while we're on this story, Rachel, I want to talk about Sophie's outfit because I loved it.
Thank you. That's a perfect outfit. I love Sophie.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. It was great. So she was in this pale kind of powder blue dress by Roland Murray, which had this bow detail on the shoulder. And you couldn't really see much of that because she paired it with this light sand colored wool coat by Max Mara. And I did want to point this out. So the outfit to me it's very flattering. Like I said, I love it. But I thought this was really cool. And I didn't know this until I went down a little, I don't know, I guess I just started researching online, digging more into this. Mm-hmm. But Roland Murray, the designer, was actually born in France. But the fashion brand was established in London. Mm. So to me, The choice of dress feels really intentional. It's like a meshing of both the UK and France, which kind of plays into this whole changing of the guard swapping. So I thought that was kind of cool. I just kind of happened to stumble up on that in my research. But what did you think about this look?
Well, first of all, that's diplomatic dressing and fashion diplomacy at its finest. That's so cool. I didn't know that. That's so cool. Kate wore that. Remember the Top Gun premiere dress that she wore with the black and white with the off the shoulder, like really like kind of like daring for her. That was Roland Murray as well. So great, great designer. The look is impeccable. I wish the Max Mara coat is beautiful. I want the dress and I want the coat, but I would love to see what the dress looks like without the coat on, of course.
Yeah.
But she looks fantastic as ever. There's your Easter color right there. She did purple at Easter, but there's your Easter color. That's a gorgeous look back to front.
I think this pale blue color really suits her well too.
It does. Yeah. I mean, Sophie just, you know, I can't remember if I've mentioned this on the show or not, but did you know that she and Edward are going to celebrate their 25th anniversary in June? That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. Gosh. That's huge. That's, I think I've mentioned it when she did that really touching speech for him for his birthday, but yeah, she looks fantastic. So I want to talk about, so if listeners, you know that if you want to visit royal residences, the best time to do that is in the summer. So it's in like the July, August time, especially July. And King Charles is making some changes to royal palaces and what we can visit, opening up some royal palaces for the first time ever. So if you are looking to go to more royal palaces than ever before, you are in luck. So the king is opening the doors. This is so cool. To Balmoral, like I'll just get cut to the chase. Like you can go to Balmoral for the first time ever. And he is also, we'll get to this in a second, but opening new parts of the continually renovated Buckingham Palace. Buckingham Palace has been under renovations for what feels like forever. They're supposed to be ongoing until 2027. Get this, you can now go to the room that leads out to the iconic Buckingham Palace balcony. Now
that's crazy.
Crazy. Now, what I haven't been able to, we bring you facts here on the show. We don't bring you conjecture. What I haven't been able to figure out yet, and I'm still working on figuring this out, is whether you can actually go on the balcony or not. You can get right up to it, whereas you could not before, but we'll talk about that in just a second. Some outlets say that you can go on the balcony. If that's the case, that is worth a pretty penny. I would pay a lot of money to go out on the balcony, but both of these places, Balmoral and this new part of Buckingham Palace, are previously unseen to the public. And Balmoral, as I said, is opening for the first time ever to the public since it was completed in 1855. So listeners, if you follow the royal family, you know Balmoral. That is where Queen Elizabeth passed away in 2022. That is where William and Harry were staying when they learned of Princess Diana's death in 1997. It's where the royal family retreats for the summer in August. And it's in the Scottish Highlands. And visitors will take a quote unquote, these are not my words, these are Balmoral's words, historic journey through several of the beautiful rooms, complete with a private guide that takes visitors through its history from when Queen Victoria and Prince Albert acquired it in 1845 to a glimpse into how the space is used today. So Balmoral tours will run from July 1st to August 4th, which is probably right up until the royal family arrives for summer vacation. And these tours are capped at 10 people per session. And People Magazine says that the general guided excursion costs, it's not cheap. It costs about $126 a person. And tickets including an afternoon tea, rise the price up to $189 per person. And all
Yeah, but
this,
you know what, Rachel? Feel like that is pretty comparable to like if you went to the Biltmore in Asheville, North Carolina. Those prices are expensive too, especially if you go like during the holidays. So I don't know if that feels comparable.
I mean,
to me.
I would pay that. No, I wouldn't even blink an eye and pay that. No questions asked. It's also important to note that this is only for adults. So you can't bring kids, no kids, just adults. So actually this is going over really well, not shockingly, with royal fans. So many of the internal Balmoral Castle tours have already sold out, but People reports that there's still plenty of availability for the Balmoral General Admission, where you can see the ballroom featuring, and this is quoting, His Majesty the King's watercolor collection, kind of cool, depicting scenery at Balmoral, Highgrove, and Sandringham, and a collection of outfits worn by their Majesties King Charles and Queen Camilla, the late Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. So let's stop there. I have a feeling that you would pay that amount of money to go to Balmoral.
Oh yeah, I mean, if I was planning a trip all the way over there anyway, I would definitely budget for a ticket for this.
So if you are going to be listeners in the Scottish Highlands, lucky you, because the Scottish Highlands are probably the most beautiful place I've ever been, then buy your ticket now because they are selling out very quickly. And again, it's only for a very limited time, just about a month. So then you've got Buckingham Palace. So Buckingham Palace has been open to the public since 1993, when Queen Elizabeth opened its doors after the devastating Windsor Castle fire the year prior to make money. And I assume, I mean, obviously that the king is opening Balmoral and then this new wing of Buckingham Palace to make money. It's a great way to make money, right? And but that said, new areas of Buckingham Palace will be available to tour for the first time this year. So the east wing of the palace, which is actually where King Charles filmed his Christmas broadcast last year, this will be available to tour for the first time ever this summer, following 5 years of restorative work. Like I said, Buckingham Palace has been under construction for what feels like forever, and there's still 3 more years to go. So the East Wing, excitingly, as I said, includes the palace's front facade and the iconic balcony where, of course, we don't have to tell you listeners, so many appearances have occurred over the years since 1851 to be exact. So royal weddings, Trooping the Colour, so on, the Platinum Jubilee. The East Wing tours will take place in July and August, starting July 15th, and the palace will be actually be open 7 days a week in July and August for the first time since 2019. Then in September, it'll scale back to its regular 5 days a week. So it is worth noting, we've mentioned this before, that while the king and queen have office space at Buckingham Palace, they don't actually live there. They choose to live at Clarence House, which is their longtime home, as Buckingham Palace continues to be in the middle of $460 million in renovations, which is probably why we're getting Balmoral and the East Wing. Yeah. And that, and again, it's not expected to be completed until 2027. So this is pretty huge. If I were anywhere near, which unfortunately I don't have plans to be this summer, if I were anywhere near Scotland or London, I would scoop those up in a heartbeat. So what are your thoughts on these new tour offerings? And I'm wondering which of the two excites you more.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was shocked when this news came out last week. And that is a tough question, Rachel. I don't know if I could choose. I mean, I've always wanted to tour Buckingham Palace. And so to be able to see that view, even if you can't actually go out on the balcony, if you can just sort of see that and be in that room that leads to that, feels really, really cool. But also Balmoral, having never been open to the public before, is also a really cool opportunity.
Even if you could just see, like, you don't even have to get on the balcony, but you can just see out, like, from the hall or whatever behind the room behind it, that would still be enough for me.
Yeah, what an incredible view.
No kidding.
Yeah, you know, so I've had a lot of thoughts about this the last week and a lot of feelings, kind of considering all the different angles. So as a tourist, I think it sounds incredible to be able to see the interiors of these places that we've really only been able to imagine up until now. And, you know, I mean, Rachel, we've done podcast episodes about this stuff and we've, we've had a few glimpses here and there, and like you said, in videos or things, but, you know, we kind of have to guess at what we think parts of these interiors look like. And, you know, so I think that's really cool. But I just also, on the other side of this, can't help but wonder if part of what makes these residences so fascinating is that unknown factor. So will opening up access to them cause it to lose some of the luster or the appeal? I mean, I really hope not, and I don't think so, but I do think opening them up for tours feels like the right thing to do. You know, if taxpayers are funding the upkeep of these buildings, it seems right to allow the public to be able to view them and tour them, you know, at various times, you know, when they're able to allow that to happen. You know, I think if we're just shutting off a palace to a small few people within the royal family, then, you know, that feels kind of a shame too. And, you know, in the same vein, when I think about it on the U.S. side, I feel very strongly that the White House should be open to tours as well. You know,
it used to be before 9/11. I actually went to tour randomly the White House in the summer of 2001. But then, of course, after 9/11, that was no more.
I think they opened it for tours when Trump was in office, if I remember correctly. I think so.
I don't know. I don't go back.
I don't know if you can now, but I was in D.C. when Obama was in office and you could not. And then I thought I had heard that you could when Trump was in office. So maybe, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the status is on that. But I do think it feels like the right thing to do to allow touring of these palaces. And, you know, so another angle of this is trying to put myself in the shoes of a member of the royal family who's kind of grown up there and consider how I might feel if I'm someone who my whole life has been on display. And now even these private places where I stay with my family kind of away from public duties are now also open to the public mm-hmm. and tourists are coming through. Well, I feel like I can't escape the fishbowl, you know, like, mm-hmm. do I never have a moment of privacy? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know how it would feel for my home to all of a sudden be a museum. Yeah. But all that considered, I think if the palace is, you know, restricting tours to certain times of the year, they're limiting ticket sales, they're obviously closing off some of the more private parts of the residences, I feel like that's a good balance. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's right. And like I said before, I would definitely purchase a ticket and go for a visit, and you would definitely have to join me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you which one excites me more. They both excite me pretty equally, but yeah, I don't think when Her Late Majesty was alive, the Balmoral would have ever been open to the public. It was too sacred to her, right? It was just too sacred. It was her place to escape. But I understand the logic. Things are expensive. We got to make some money. And so I'm all for it. If I ever had the chance to go and wave off of the Buckingham Palace balcony, I would just keel over and die. How cool is that? And of course, Balmoral, Scotland, period, is just the most beautiful place in the world that I've ever been to anyway. And this is really exciting. So I think you're right. It strikes the right balance between, you know, letting the taxpayers, letting people see the royal residences, the royal offices, so on and so forth at Buckingham Palace, but also limiting it so that it can also still continue to be the summer retreat Balmoral that it has been for so long.
Every time we see the royal family out on the balcony, I have always imagined what's on the other side.
I know, right? Like I want to be back. Like I said, even if I could just stand in that room and just look out, chills, right? Like, so cool.
Yeah, but I do wonder though, if the decision to do this, I mean, I definitely think the ability to bring in some more revenue is probably a factor there. But I also wonder if part of the reasoning to do this is maybe to make the royals a little bit more, you know, even more, I don't know if approachable is the right word, but likable, you know. Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm thinking like the likability factor, because at some point, you know, people don't want to be viewed as just the wealthy king who never lets anyone, you know, have access to anything, and they mm-hmm. enjoy the nice palaces, you know. So I think if they can say, sure, you know, we can open up some areas of this to the public, and mm-hmm. you pay for the upkeep of this is, you know, your place too, to come and enjoy. I feel like that would be, yeah, I don't know. If I was in that role, I think I would kind of think about that too, is, you know, what yeah. can we do to kind of share this with the public that's helping pay for it?
Well, and one more quick note, we were like, what, 7 in 1993 when Buckingham Palace opened. I can't remember life before it being open. So that's weird to think that, like, it was at one point in my life, it was not open. So
yeah.
I think, you know, we'll get more and more as time goes on. I'm not really sure what else there is to show, but very, very exciting. So if it's great travel opportunity, go grab those tickets now, because they're selling fast.
Definitely.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, let's close out the royal rundown with some news that actually just popped up today. So King Charles, he was working, he was at a work event today, and he was presented with the first banknotes containing his image as king. So he had actually already seen this image that would be used a while back, but this was the first time that he was issued the notes. It was today. So his picture will be on the 5, 10, 20, and 50 pound bills, which are scheduled to enter public circulation on June 5th. And the plan is actually to take a more sustainable approach. So rather than going in and eliminating all of the banknotes with Queen Elizabeth's picture, they're going to keep those in rotation as well. And they're only going to replace the worn, damaged notes. And so when those are coming out of rotation, they'll fill those in with new ones containing the king's picture. So the late Queen Elizabeth, I thought this was pretty cool. She was the first monarch to ever be pictured on a bill, which means this is the first time ever that the Bank of England has had to change over the bill with a new monarch's image. So kind of interesting to think about, because I feel like, I don't know, doesn't it seem like this wouldn't be the first time that that would happen?
Yeah, just like the Buckingham Palace thing. You know, it's so interesting how history works. You think something's been done forever, but we're just a speck in the, you know, grand plan of history, I guess.
Yeah. And I think we discussed this on a previous episode, but, you know, Queen Elizabeth, and on her banknotes, she's wearing a crown in her picture, and King Charles is not. So a little bit different kind of approach there as well. And today they actually, in the event, they showed him a picture of, you know, the banknote with his photo, and he said he thought it looked elegant. And I was thinking it's actually really sweet to think about how he and his mother both share the honor of having their pictures on bills in rotation at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I hope that they continue this trend with future monarchs and only kind of eliminate those bills once they're worn and used, mm-hmm. and then introduce new ones in. I think that'd be kind of cool to have different ones all kind of in rotation together. But I had to ask you, Rachel, what did you think about Charles' decision not to wear a crown in his photo in comparison to Queen Elizabeth's? Do you think he should have been wearing one, or do you like that?
I don't really mind it. I think it's probably to the point that you were just making, that it's to be more relatable and more accessible and approachable. And I get it. You know, I mean, I think we're living in a time, especially when you're spending money and you're looking at someone wearing a crown and you might be struggling financially. You know, I think that that makes you probably have like really poor thoughts about the monarchy. Right. And so, you know, yeah, I think it's definitely the right move as the monarchy continues to evolve and be more relatable to the public.
Yeah, I agree. I had the same thought as that likability factor. I think that was probably maybe had something to do with that
choice. I think it had a lot to do with it, but I think it was a smart move.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move, shall we, into royals around the world. We actually have some good little nuggets today. So let's go to the Netherlands. Princess Catherine Amalia, one of our favorite upcoming royals to watch. She's 20 years old. She's future queen of the Netherlands. She is slowly taking on more and more royal duties. And one of those duties will be attending her first ever state banquet this month, where she will join her parents in welcoming Spain's royal family. So crossover of two royal families that we love, the royal family of Netherlands and the royal family of Spain. So King Philippe and Queen Letizia of Spain will visit the Netherlands on a state visit from April 17th to April 18th, and Catherine Amalia is expected to attend the banquet. So the Spanish royals will be in town right as a new series, I want to watch this, but I don't know if they're going to have it here in the U.S., premieres depicting the life of Queen Maxima and her relationship with King Willem Alexander. The show is called Maxima, I don't even know how to, Zorig, I'm just going to spell it, Zorregiuita, Motherland, which this show is similar to Netflix's The Crown about Queen Elizabeth. So Queen Elizabeth is to the crown what Maxima is to this show. So it is going to cover the bulk of Maxima's life. I love Queen Maxima, and so this is going to be something that I would love to watch if it ever should become available in the U.S. It's going to look at her early years in Argentina and dramatizing the chance meeting of a crown prince that changed her life forever. So lots there. Oh. The show I want to see, but also good first for Catherine Amalia. So that's exciting all the way around.
Yeah, that is really cool. So we have some more news from, we've got Denmark and Sweden next. So we did talk last episode about Easter plans of some of our royals, but since then we did learn a few more. And I, you know, we don't get too much into the details of their private vacations, but we did hear that King Frederick and Queen Mary of Denmark took a ski trip vacation in Switzerland last week for Easter, and then Crown Princess Victoria and Prince Daniel, they were with their children in Mallorca, Spain on holiday. So very cool. And then the King and Queen of Sweden actually had a little night out this last week. So King Carl Gustaf and Queen Sylvia actually attended a concert this past weekend in Stockholm, and the concert was honoring the band ABBA. And it's actually been 50 years since the band won the Eurovision Song Contest with Waterloo. And if you didn't know, ABBA is a Swedish band. So fun fact there. But the actual band itself was not in attendance for the concert. It was just kind of honoring them. So they had their music being played there by other musicians. And the king and queen were seen enjoying themselves, dancing along. And I know listeners probably remember we talked about this on, I think, more than one episode in the past, but the band has a really special connection to the queen. So when the king and queen were engaged, ABBA actually performed for them. I think it was the night before their wedding. And they dedicated their song Dancing Queen to Queen Sylvia.
I love that little nugget.
I know, that's so fun. I remember learning that and thinking that was really cool. But Saturday's concert, like I said, she was dancing along to the music. They were actually technically on sort of a double date. So they were joined by King Carl Gustaf's sister and her husband. And continuing with this green fashion theme that we were talking about last week, Queen Sylvia was in this bright green emerald, like a two-piece suit. Looked really great and perfect for a concert featuring Dancing Queen.
I just love that factoid. That's one of my favorite royals around the world factoids.
Well, it's interesting because it's such a big song. I mean, everybody hears that song and knows the song. And but yet we never really knew this fun little fact.
I wonder if every time that song plays, I mean, which like, I guess it doesn't play that often anymore. But if I were Sylvia, I'd be like, that song is my song. That's my song. That song was written for my wedding. What song was written for your wedding? So anyway, I think that's so cool.
Well, let's close things out with a story out of Denmark. This feels so random what I'm about to talk about. Rachel, I went on an Instagram rabbit hole the other day, and I was actually looking at this story, but it led me down this other rabbit hole. And so I'll share.
I went down a rabbit hole this week too with the royals. So I feel you. Me and the Princess Diana Museum are intimately acquainted at this point.
Well, Queen Mary of Denmark was at a royal engagement related to some forest land. So a little bit of backstory. Dyrehaven, which actually means deer park in Danish, is a forest park. It's one of Denmark's most frequented natural areas, and it's actually home to a lot of rare plants and animals. I believe there's like 116 endangered species in this forest. So a very protected area, and they've decided to expand Dyrehaven into some untouched forest land. And that's known as, and again, pardon my accent here, I believe it's Jägersborgen. And so this expansion is going to allow more space for these endangered species in the area to kind of roam about and live. And in honor of this, Queen Mary attended this expansion ceremony of the forest land, and she actually got to release two deer into this new part of the forest. And cool. Fun fact, the deer she released are apparently descendants of deer that were first placed in the area by King Frederick III, who reigned in the 1600s.
Oh, wow.
So these
Was
are
this
like,
the rabbit hole you went down or the deer hole?
No, no, we're about to get to the rabbit hole.
Okay.
This was fascinating to me. Talk about some royal deer. They, you know, can track their family history back to the 1600s, which not a lot of deer can probably do that. but so at the entry of this forest, there's this big red gate, and Queen Mary, as part of this event, she unveiled the new monogram of King Frederick, or, you know, the current King of Denmark, at the top of the gate. And she gave a speech at the event. She said, "Starting today, Dyrehaven will be a quarter bigger for the joy of all of us who love to come here and for all the life that belongs here." And she went on to share a few more words, and she closed out with, "As long as we remember that we are guests in the garden while animals and plants have a home here." I thought that was really sweet.
That is sweet.
Okay, are you ready to hear about this rabbit hole?
Yeah, I have no idea what you're about to say. So,
so I was looking at the photos, and I actually shared some of the photos on our Instagram account today. If you want to go see the deer that she released into the forest, you can go check that out. But somehow or another, when I was on this post, I clicked some Instagram handle. I don't know if it was someone that liked the page or something, but somehow or another, I landed on this like European wildlife page that was highlighting hunters around Europe and different animals that they had, you know, hunted, and they had lots of photos of these different animals. And one of the animals that I came across was a Chinese water deer. Have you ever heard of this, Rachel?
I can't say I have. No, I have
okay,
not.
Okay, so this is what I started researching. I was like, what is a Chinese water deer? It looked very interesting. So it's a type of small deer. And as the name suggests, it originates from China and Korea. But over time, it's been imported into some European countries, including England. And these little deer only get to be a couple of feet tall, and they weigh between 20 and 30 pounds. But the interesting fact is they don't have antlers. So instead of antlers, they have tusks. And
wait, tusks, you said?
Yes, which are, you know, often referred to as fangs, and they look like fangs kind of growing out of their mouth. Oh. And I'm not kidding at all. They're long fangs out of their mouth. And because of this, the deer are often known as vampire deer.
This is the rabbit hole you went down.
Yes. So okay. These deer are very skilled swimmers. And instead of, you know, you think of a big deer in the forest as, you know, fighting other deer with their antlers, they actually fight off predators with their fangs. And so I just found this fascinating. If listeners aren't familiar with these, and Rachel, go Google Chinese water
I'm gonna
deer.
Have to now.
Go look it up. It's really cool. But as I mentioned, they're only, you know, they can be found in different parts of England as they've been imported in. So some of the areas in England where you can find them are Norfolk, Bedfordshire, and Cambridgeshire. So there's a little fun fact tying into
you
my rabbit hole.
You never know, listeners, what the heck you're going to get on Podcast Royal from week to week. From Diana Museum to Vampire Deer, we are just full circle here. Okay, well, now I've got to Google this and see what you mean with these tusks or fangs or whatever. Cannot say I've ever heard of that before, but see, that's why being a royal correspondent is cool, is because you learn things like that, like, how would I have ever, like, when William did that, like, microbial something, how would I have ever known that? So,
well, yeah. we have a farm here, and, you know, we see lots of deer, and so I immediately had to call my dad the other night and ask him about these Chinese water deer. We don't have them in the South.
Has he ever heard of one, though?
Yeah, he had, yes.
Well, he's cooler than me. I'm not really up on my deer, but you know I'll be Googling that in just a minute. And actually, I might go do that right now, because we are done with episode 135. Anything else for the good of the order before we wrap up?
No, hope everybody enjoyed the eclipse. Hope everyone had fun this episode. Definitely go check out the photo of Queen Mary releasing the deer in the forest and send us a message and let us know if you've heard about the Chinese water deer.
Well, I'll tell you how to send that message about Chinese water deer right now. So you can DM us on Instagram at Podcast Royal. Always have DMs open. Always have emails open at hellopodcastroyal@gmail.com. And that wraps up episode 135 of Podcast Royal. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.